City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Oh, I like that.
I'm Kelly Simpkins.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
Listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 342. I'm Amy Matheny.
I'm Kelly Simpkins.
And we're on the couch at home.
The couch. Queer couch.
The queer couch. It's been a long time since you've been on the show.
It's been a long, long time.
You've been away.
I've been away.
You and I went, you've been all over. You've been in Virginia and Kalamazoo. And you've been in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And we've discussed, I think, a bit, you know, the last time that you were on that you were dealing a lot with the Laramie Project epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I just took a trip to New York.
We
which
did.
Kind of kicked off a bit of the holiday season, and we got to see a little theater. We got to see Next to Normal.
Mm-hmm.
And what'd you think?
Loved it.
Yep.
Pissed that Alice Ripley wasn't in it, but loved it.
I know. We got the understudy. I thought she was great. But you were really sad because you really wanted to see Alice Ripley.
I was sad, but she was great.
Yeah.
I don't think it affected the show.
How would you describe that show to somebody?
Rockin' bipolar melancholy.
Rockin' bipolar melancholy?
Great songs, great storyline, great band, really, I think, amazing direction.
You're not a
like
musical
a new
lover, right?
Epic in the musical theater land. I'm not, and this is not a traditional musical, which is what I loved about it.
Yeah.
It was very touching, extremely engaging. I felt very connected to those characters, and it was a scene.
Yeah. It's really a great show. Of course, Alice Ripley won the Tony Award, and she was out the night that we went, but I really thought that the show is a new language in musical theater, and I don't know why. I don't know if it was the subject matter that was so uncharted or the form. I really, really thought Michael Greif's direction was amazing. Mm-hmm. And of course, he did Rent. And I've never been the big Rent fan that everybody else was. Rent at the time was considered the new musical, the new way for musical theater to go. And interesting that, again, now I think people are saying, you know, this is the non-Disney musical. This is the a new story, a new fresh story that we don't know. It's not a retelling of a movie or of a cartoon or something like that. I mean, even with Grey Gardens, if you'd said that was new, it was based on a documentary. You know, this is a fresh new story born, you know, of this world. And really fascinating, I thought. Amazing cast.
Amazing cast. I just think it's a family that you can connect to. And I think the music and the lyrics are really beautiful, really unique. And it's an extremely theatrical show.
We also saw The Vibrator play by mm-hmm. Sarah Rule and directed by Les Waters. And Sarah Rule making her Broadway debut. She's a Chicagoan, and though not gay, seems to include gay characters often in her storylines, and there is definitely some lesbianism, but how could there not be? And also, I think, just some kind of, for the time, kind of queer sexual politics, anal sex for the guy exploring the vibrator. I mean, it's essentially about the
birth. He didn't have anal sex.
Well, he didn't,
Let's be clear.
No, he did not have anal sex.
He had hysteria that was...
Yes, well, I mean, the whole play is about the birth of electricity, and that with Thomas Edison came new devices that were used for medical purposes. And to cure hysteria, which they often saw in women, they developed this vibrating tool that was almost medicinal, that women would, this was truly the birth of the vibrator, was that supposedly it would calm her womb, so to speak.
Release the fluid, the buildup of fluid from the womb.
Yeah, the hysteria. So, you know, it's based in some historical accuracy. Of course, it is comedy. And almost a drawing room comedy, which is kind of strange to watch people masturbating on stage in Victorian or turn of the century.
Well, they didn't know they were masturbating.
Well, they didn't know they were masturbating, right. It's definitely got the shocking title.
Or being masturbated.
I think that the show will come to Chicago eventually. I think one of the big theaters here will do it. But if you're in New York, it's definitely engaging and funny and worth seeing. And Sarah Rule's first big Broadway show. So the reviews have been great out on that. It's kind of exciting to be in New York during the holiday time.
To be in New York.
You love New York.
I love it.
So they had not put up the Rockefeller tree yet. But we had
they had not lit the tree.
They had not lit the tree.
They had put the tree up.
Right. But you know, my experience of New York here a couple weeks ago was that, you know, it's interesting that to me, New York is like this small microcosm of what's happening across the U.S. And I did feel that there was a change in energy in the city. And I don't know if that's the economics of what's going on. I felt everything was far more palpable there than I kind of experience it here in Chicago. Maybe it's because it's just so much more congested, so everything feels more potent there.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an exciting city, and we had a lot of fun. We saw a lot of friends. We saw Tyne Daly on the street.
We did.
Which I did not, you know, accost her and stop her. And I should have. Then you would have met Cagney and Lacey
That's
in your
true.
Lifetime.
That would have been a...
It could still happen.
A coup.
That would have been a coup. Did we see anybody else famous? You always see
I saw Ron Rifkin.
Yeah, you did. He plays the gay uncle on Brothers and Sisters.
With his green glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the guy from the Backstreet Boys. I never remember his
name. Oh, Lance Bass.
Who's also gay.
You had lots of gay sightings,
I had gay
didn't
sightings.
You?
And then I had another sighting, and I can't
did
remember
Did you speak
who
to Lance
now.
Bass?
No,
did
no,
you go,
no.
Hey,
there
gay
was
dude? No? You didn't say, hey, gay dude? I don't
I
know.
Did not I say, hey, gay dude.
I don't know. It could be fun. Bye, bye, bye. No, that's NSYNC. Was he NSYNC? He was an NSYNCer.
Is that Justin Timberlake?
Yeah, he was not a Backstreet Boy.
Okay, he was NSYNC.
That shows you how lesbian we are, that we don't know the difference between NSYNC and Backstreet Boys.
It's true.
Yeah.
No, I don't find it sad.
You don't find it sad?
I don't.
Was he cute?
Very cute. And some rabid fan was screeching across the street with her camera to get a
oh,
picture
really?
Of him. Yeah, it was a very quiet little street down in the West Village, and she was just running across with high giggles and screeches trying to get a photo, which
Lance
he took
Bass!
With her.
Oh, my God. Sounded
kind of...
Did it sound like that?
Not imbued with the old
Lance
lady.
Lance Bass, gay guy! No?
No.
No, oh, okay.
Write in and tell her if you think that one was funny.
No, it wasn't funny. But, you know, it's interesting because he was the first rocker, I mean, if we call him a rocker, gay pop music person of note that came out. And, of course, the buzz has all been about Adam Lambert. And as we walked down the streets of New York, we saw pasted all the posters on all of the, you know, alleyways and walls, his new poster for his new CD, which is now out. But he caused so much controversy at the American Music Awards with this number that he did where he was I don't know, kind of pansexual, writhing all. I thought it was a very weak performance. Let's just go there. I just didn't like the song. I didn't like his performance. I thought he needed to just stay still and not climb the entire jungle gym, mauling people and grabbing his privates. I mean, you know, in a year that we're honoring Michael Jackson.
You didn't say crutch.
Well, it wasn't even just that. It was like just kind of grabbing people and lots of thrusting. And I just thought, oh, Adam, it doesn't need to be so. You're so much more powerful when you just stand still and just sing or sit in a chair and sing. You know, it just,
but
he was working
kind of
way
all
too
about
hard.
The theatrics. I didn't see it, so I can't comment on it. But he's all about the theatrical presentation.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to. That doesn't mean you have to run around an entire jungle gym to be theatrical. I mean, we both know that. But it was just interesting because he grabbed a, I thought it was a girl when I watched it live. I thought he grabbed like this girl who kind of looked like Pink, you know, spiky short hair, and kissed her. And it was actually a guy in the band who happens to be a straight guy. Of course, that piece of information has come out after the fact. But we haven't talked about it at all on the podcast. But it is continuing to build momentum because the next day he was uninvited to appear on Good Morning America based on immediate controversy that happened from it. Then he was invited to the early show or the Today show to sing, and yet they would not. They blurred out the image of him kissing the guy as they were discussing the controversy. Now, we all know we've seen Madonna and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera lip lock a million times. We've seen a lot of women kiss. We watch on television shows, you know, on Grey's Anatomy now and Brothers and Sisters, you know, people of same sex kiss. And, you know, a lot of people, including the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, are screaming foul and almost a reverse sexism about this, that we can look at women kiss women, but God forbid we look at two guys, you know. And it wasn't even sexual. It was just like grab somebody and kiss them and walk past them. Do you think there's continues to be a double standard? And what do you think about all of this? I mean, is this just good for Adam Lambert, the controversy, or... And did he get what he wanted? Is that what he wanted?
I can't speak for what he wanted.
Well, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think
he's all into the theatrics.
He seems like a pretty shock and awe person.
Really?
Yeah.
No? He doesn't to me. He doesn't seem to me like he's just out to shock. You know, I think he was out to entertain and perform, but I don't think he's out to shock. I've yet to say that that's what I think he is. I'm wondering if the people who are handling him don't want to utilize him in that way.
Well, that might be true.
I don't know.
But he seems to, I mean, you know, Bowie might be a stretch, but he seems to have the makeup and this kind of androgynous presentation. And, you know, on American Idol, from what I remember, he didn't stand with an acoustic guitar and just tap his toe. I mean, he was blasting and blaring and rocking out, and
well, I think,
and it might be like a publicity bent, like, you know, they're kind of pushing him to really amp up who he already is to see how much kind of publicity they can get from the shock.
And
of
yet, I think
things.
That him. Doing...
But I think it's, you know, my opinion is, fuck him. I think it's horrible.
Yeah.
Because we have seen a lot of people kiss, and I think there is, I think more people are comfortable with lesbian kissing than they are with men kissing.
Or straight women kissing.
Or straight women kissing.
Yeah, which was, I guess, what happened with Madonna, Christina Aguilera, and Britney Spears.
Right.
I mean, well, they're slightly bent, but they're straight women.
Yeah.
They're all married or divorced many times. But I think that, you know, where he was strongest... You know, you say blasting it out, and maybe so, but I think many people thought his strongest performance was when he did the Tears for Fears number.
Yeah.
And he sat in chair, and he really didn't do all of the vocal gymnastics. I mean, I've listened to the CD. I did not download it. I downloaded the new Lady Gaga, which I strongly recommend. That's right. But, you know, I really just wanted him to have more... I don't want him just to be a dance artist. I think he has the potential to not just be a dance artist. And maybe he'll have a dance cut, and that would have been fine. But it seems like this is the vein in which he's going into. And it would have been really fun to see him go to a far harder rock edge with some amazing ballads on it. Maybe a pop song, or let them remix a song of his and make it into a dance song for the clubs. But I think he went way too safe and way too pop. But you know what? Kelly Clarkson's first CD was not great. You know, sometimes it takes them, the artists, to win, and I essentially think he won, even though he didn't win. You know, it takes them sometimes a while to hit their stride when they get their own more of their own control over the
Yeah, or to find out who they are and remain true to that. I think it's really, really hard when you're young and you get signed and there's a lot of money at stake and a lot of people pushing you and telling you who they want you to be.
Well, he bought a lot.
How you're going to sell albums.
Well, he sold a lot. I mean, he has his pre-sales alone already, like, busted through the roof. So he's already been a success. Whereas that's concerned, it just can, it will, you know, be seen how many more he signs. But he's definitely doing something about pushing the envelope with sexuality, gender expression, and I think that's cool. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's a great segue to our guest today. Charles Bush is on the show, drag icon, playwright.
Performer.
An amazing man who has created quite a, has pioneered, I think, a road, maybe started by some others, and he'll talk about that, some of his early influences. But he has definitely made his mark in the theater world and made a name for himself as something very unique in the world of theater, in the world of drag performance, and in queer culture. And so I've never interviewed Charles before, and it was really exciting to sit down and talk with him. And he is coming with his longtime friend, collaborator, and muse, Julie Halston, to be a part of the Fresh Squeezed Queer Series at Victory Gardens. And he'll be here for one night only this coming Monday. So I sit down with Charles Bush in what is really a very exciting interview for me. And I hope for you, I hope you'll enjoy it. And also, we've got lots of news. Adam Lambert, not the only thing in the news. Also telling you what else is going on in the theater world, because Kelly and I just went to see The Christmas Carol. Great thing to do.
Lovely
for the holiday season. Larry Ando.
It's amazing.
Hilarious. Yeah. Great show.
Really great show.
I think
show.
It's probably the most produced play in the U.S., I would imagine. I would imagine, because it's done annually so much every year that it's just how many people have seen The Christmas Carol is extraordinary. So that's a suggestion from us, but there's much, much, much more going on and a lot of great queer shows during the holiday season. So we'll be back after these messages, and Charles Bush will be with us.
Hi there. I'm a Miller Lite Brewmaster.
And I'm a Miller Lite Drinkmaster.
It's the Brewmaster Drinkmaster Show.
You know, most people know that Miller Lite tastes great, but up until now, only brewmasters like me knew why.
Well, most people know that my friends and I are the most dominating presence in the Kalamazoo Western Division Level 3 Softball League, but very few know why.
Huh. You see, we add the hops first for flavor, second for balance, and a third time to lock in the great Pilsner taste by enhancing the foamy head.
Yeah, well, we don't need fancy softball strategery to win.
We call it the triple hops brewing process.
Well, we call it heart, Mr. Man.
We're on the same team here. I thought you would appreciate this new information.
I apologize. I just wish I had something as important to share.
Well, buy a six-pack of Miller Lite and you will.
Miller Lite brewmasters have to know the ins and outs of triple hops brewing. The only thing you have to do is enjoy the great-tasting light beer. Miller Lite. Great taste, less filling. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Live responsibly.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Weekend News. The Human Rights Campaign has joined leaders and advocates in launching Our Families Count at www.ourfamiliescount.org, a new voluntary public education initiative promoting LGBT visibility and participation in next year's U.S. Census.
A Vermont family court judge, William Cohen, granted custody of 7-year-old Isabella Miller to her lesbian, non-biological mother, Janet Jenkins. Jenkins and former partner Lisa Miller broke up in 2003 after Miller said she was no longer gay. Judge Cohen wrote, "In the long term, the change of custody will be in Isabella's best interests, as she will have the opportunity for maximum continuing physical and emotional contact with both parents." Lisa Miller plans to appeal the ruling.
The ACLU of Puerto Rico has said that their Department of Justice will investigate the murder of Jorge Steven Lopez Mercado as a hate crime. The department will also train judges and prosecuting attorneys on procedures regarding hate crimes. Mercado's body was found November 13th. He had been decapitated, dismembered, and burned.
In Atlanta, the Lloyd E. Russell Foundation donated $12,000 to help start a new gay publication since the Southern Voice shut down. The nonprofit was started to support the gay community in Atlanta and the Southeast.
In Massachusetts, Republican gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker has chosen openly gay state senator Richard Tisay as his running mate. Tisay is the only openly gay Republican in the state legislature. There are 6 gay and lesbian Democrats, including Representative Sarah Peek of Provincetown.
An FBI report revealed the number of victims of hate crimes based on sexual orientation increased by 11% in 2008. President Barack Obama signed the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act on October 28th.
A Massachusetts court has rejected transgender white killer Robert Michelle Kosolek's attempt to get taxpayer-funded electrolysis treatments. Kosolek, 60, had previously received 7 Department of Corrections-approved treatments at $500 each because attorneys argued that the procedures were medical necessities. Kosolek is in prison for life after strangling wife Cheryl in 1990.
A Canadian court has ordered the country's refugee board to review the previously rejected asylum application of Bethany Smith, a lesbian U.S. soldier who said she received death threats because of her sexual orientation. Smith, age 21, claimed that she was constantly harassed, verbally and physically, and that she asked to be discharged after being outed. Smith served at Kentucky's Fort Campbell, where Private First Class Barry Winchell was beaten to death 10 years ago.
In world news, an ESPN writer detailed the coming-out story of Brendan Burke, the son of Brian Burke, the general manager of the National Hockey League's Toronto Maple Leafs. Brendan, a student manager for the Miami of Ohio University hockey team, came out 2 years ago.
Chris Rumble and Warren McGaugh held Australia's first legal same-sex civil ceremony. The Australian Capital Territories legalized same-sex relationships in May of 2008. However, gay couples could not formalize their relationships until amendments took effect in mid-November of this year. However, gay couples have to pay $199 to have their relationships registered, and married couples do not have to do that.
In South Asia, non-government organizations will receive $47 million to help in the reduction of potential HIV/AIDS-related cases. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria will distribute the grant money to launch the community-based program. The 5-year program will focus on gay and trans individuals in Afghanistan, India, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka.
In Scotland, 2 officers have been disciplined for sending anti-gay emails to colleagues. The emails were traced to the pair at Edinburgh's Leith police station.
In Jamaica, a gay man who was in a jealous rage held down his lover and gouged out his eyes. The alleged suspect eventually went to the Halfway Tree police station and said he had acted in self-defense. The victim will not likely see again as the optic nerve was badly damaged.
And in entertainment news, the Fox series Dollhouse, starring Eliza Dushku, who has a huge lesbian following, has been canceled. The show will finish its 2nd season, order of 13 episodes.
Art Smith, who shot to fame as Oprah Winfrey's personal chef, will host a show on TLC called Craving Comfort. He will travel the United States exploring variations of popular dishes, such as fried chicken. The openly gay Smith told Windy City Times that, through the show, he wants to help inspire and create comfort for others.
Liborio Molina, the manager of the Black Eyed Peas, has been cleared of assaulting openly gay celebrity blogger Perez Hilton. Molina apologized to Hilton as part of an agreement, allowing charges to be dropped. Molina reportedly punched Hilton outside a Canadian nightclub after Hilton called Black Eyed Peas' Will.i.am a faggot.
CBS is defending the early show's decision to blur the image of Adam Lambert kissing his male keyboard player during the American Music Awards. GLAAD president Jarrett Berrios said it reinforces an unfortunate double standard that is applied to the openly gay performers. However, CBS replied, regarding a previous image with Madonna, Britney Spears, and Christina Aguilera, that it is very familiar and has appeared countless times, including many times on morning television. The Adam Lambert image is a subject of great current controversy and may still lead to legal consequences. CBS's early show had Lambert on November 25th after ABC's Good Morning America canceled his scheduled appearance.
CNN anchor Anderson Cooper is reportedly in love with bar owner Ben Masani, and they have supposedly been house hunting in New York. The twosome have been seeing each other for the past 8 months. Some say Cooper is so much in love that he may publicly acknowledge his sexuality for the first time.
New Moon star Taylor Lautner did not directly answer a gay-related question from Rolling Stone. When asked if he prefers men or women, Lautner responded, "Okay, I see where you're going. Interesting choice. There's a lot of rumors out there." Lautner added that he and rumored girlfriend Taylor Swift were close, but did not confirm that they were dating.
Entourage's Rex Lee admitted there are occasional on-set jokes aimed at his sexuality and ethnicity. Lee added that he did not have the joke tellers fired because that's not the way I work. Entourage creator Doug Ellen said he was shocked and horrified by the revelation and said that he would speak to the cast before they film again in March.
And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda, composer and lyricist of the Broadway show In the Heights. In the Heights is a show about life in the city. People like you and me, living and working and dreaming big. The music has salsa, merengue, hip-hop. This stuff has never been on Broadway before. Winning the Tony Award for Best Musical and a Grammy for the album, it's an amazing feeling when your dreams come true.
Coming December 15th through January 3rd to the Cadillac Palace Theater. For tickets, visit BroadwayInChicago.com.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of December 1st, 2009, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Join the American Blues Theater family as they take you back to the 1944 radio broadcast of It's a Wonderful Life, live at the Biograph, with live Foley sound effects, an original score, and a stellar cast that brings the entire town of Bedford Falls to life. From the original director and ensemble of the Chicago holiday tradition, playing through December 27th at the Victory Gardens Biograph Theater, visit AmericanBluesTheater.com.
Court Theater presents The Mystery of Irma Vep, written by Charles Ludlam. Irma Vep satirizes all that is ridiculous in gothic horror, classic film, and conventional theater. And it's also a contender for the funniest American play of the last quarter century. Playing now, get your tickets for Irma Vep at courttheater.org.
You met him as George Gershwin in George Gershwin Alone, then as Frederick Chopin, now Hershey Felder returns to Chicago as the greatest composer of them all, Ludwig van Beethoven, in Beethoven as I Knew Him, featuring some of the composer's most well-known works. Don't miss Beethoven as I Knew Him, playing now through December 20th at Drury Lane Water Tower Place. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com.
Don't miss out on an evening with Charles Bush and Julie Halston on December 7th. The original vampire lesbians will take the stage to tell their story from Sodom to Broadway in a special show as a part of the Victory Gardens Fresh Squeezed Queer Series at Victory Gardens Biograph Theater, 2433 North Lincoln Avenue. Get tickets now for an evening with Charles Bush and Julie Halston December 7th by visiting victorygardens.org.
David Bowie's Christmas Special 1977, back for a second straight season. Cap off a visit to the Macy's Windows and Chris Kindlemarked with a trip to Spiders from Mars Space Station. Playing now, Fridays and Saturdays through December 19th at 11 p.m. at National Pastime Theater, 4139 North Broadway. Tickets are only $15. Visit www.nmtchicago.org for reservations and info.
You're invited to a marvelous party. Writers Theater presents the musical comedy review, Oh Coward. Acclaimed director Jim Cordy brings Noel Coward's effervescent music, quips, and wit to life. Be transported to a 1930s nightclub for a must-see evening of the most memorable tunes of the 20th century. Tickets are selling quickly, so order yours today at writerstheater.org.
Meet Florence Foster Jenkins in Souvenir, the uproarious story inspired by a tone-deaf socialite destined for Carnegie Hall. A touching and comic tribute to Ms. Jenkins' sincerity, ambition, and complete lack of talent, Souvenir chronicles her unlikely journey from laughingstock to musical legend. Playing at Northlight Theater through December 20th, visit northlight.org for tickets to Souvenir. And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hey guys, this is Elizabeth Kina, and you're on the Windy City Queercast. Have a good one.
I crawl from you, 'cause we met on the day I was born. And your face, a godlike sun, filling every hole with almighty glue. Ooh, I followed you, 'cause I found a new religion. Like a tongue wagging acolyte, then you kissed me and opened the door. Oh God, there's something about you.
original vampire lesbians of Sodom, Charles Bush and Julie Halston, will be on stage again, but this time as a part of Victory Garden's Fresh Squeezed series here in Chicago. Known for his iconic alter ego in films such as Psycho, Beach Party, and Die, Mommy, Die, Charles Bush truly has broken down barriers and carved new territory as a queer artist. One could call him a triple threat, writer, director, actor, but that would be limiting to his work as screenwriter, novelist, drag icon, and more. His body of work is absolutely so incredibly prolific. It is just going to be a not-to-be-missed evening, Monday, December 7th, when Charles is here and he is joined by his dear friend and muse, Julie Halston. And we're so honored to have you on the Queercast. Hey, Charles.
Well, hey, Liz. It's great to be with you, and I'm really excited about being in Chicago. You know, I went to Northwestern and then lived in Chicago for 2 years after I graduated, and actually, really, I guess I could say I began my career in Chicago.
Yeah, I read that you were from Northwestern, which was a tidbit I did not know. What kind of college student were you? Were you a theater geek? Were you already kind of flamboyant and in becoming an artiste and expressive?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York City, and I just always wanted to be in theater all mm-hmm. my life. And when I went to Northwestern, I was a theater major. I went there with the intention of being forced to be reckoned with in the theater department, but I really right away got the gist that I was just a little too gay and too odd, and you know, so I never was cast in a play.
Yeah,
but I really was kind of a big loser, really. And but the good thing about Northwestern for me was that it did have the liberal arts program, and which I had resisted. I really just wanted to go to an acting school, but because they had all these other courses, I became more interested in writing, and and turned out to serve me very well.
Now, it was there, as you just said, that you started writing, and you really found your place on the stage and in the spotlight in doing solo work. At that time, were there people that you were inspired by to do this kind of work? I mean, because at the time, I don't think that you were really a pioneer in terms of being kind of a queer voice in the theater.
Well, yes and no. Really, I was fortunate that I came along in the 70s, and there were the people really, I think, made the... were a little more courageous or insane were people in the 60s, like Charles Ludlam, who was a big influence on me. And you know, so the really, you know, when I, particularly a little bit later when I sort of became the drag diva, it was a bit easier for me because, you know, I was immediately reviewed in major newspapers where those before me had to fight to get that coverage. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can't pat myself on the back too much. And then as a solo performer, which that was kind of the first stage of my career, I guess, I was influenced by, you know, just all sorts of avant-garde people who maybe wouldn't be known to the general public, like Jeff Weiss, you know, just, you know, in New York, in the 70s, it was kind of a golden age of avant-garde theater.
Right.
And so when I particularly could come home for vacations from college, you know, I started seeing a lot of avant-garde theater just because often the people would be naked, you know. it was kind of sexy, for a horny teenager, you know. It was kind of like seeing naked guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, it became very inspiring artistically at the same time. But that was kind of went through with hope that you'd see a naked guy.
When did you don drag for the first time? When did you start exploring drag? When did you even see a drag performer for the first time?
Gosh. Well, I think Charles Ludlam, in a way, when I saw his, he had his theater company called the Ridiculous Theatrical Company. And,
right.
And, yeah, and what was sort of a revelation for me was just that we had similar interests. All my interests in old movies and theatrical history and the opera I could see reflected in his work, and it gave me hope that maybe a theatrical experience could just be whatever I chose it to be, as opposed to trying to eke out a career in the commercial theater, where I had this gut feeling that I may not fit in.
Right.
So I think maybe first my sort of theatrical drag was Loveland. Mm. And actually, when I lived in Chicago, I was doing some drag performing. In my senior year in college, I wrote a sort of Loveland-esque play and put it on campus with my best friend Ed, and that was very encouraging. You know, I thought, oh, this feels right. This feels somehow creating my own work. You know, this maybe is the path for me. You know,
you brought one of those first shows back to Chicago, didn't you? After you went to Victory Gardens, right?
When I stayed in Chicago, well, that's kind of a little bit later. Just somehow try to get to the gist of it. When I lived in Chicago after I graduated, I wrote some movie spoof pieces, where I performed in drag, and I was performing in bars and discos and sometimes even the Village Movie Theater. I don't know if it's still there, but I used to perform there after the last movie was over. And so I had a little theater company that we, for about a year, that we used to perform. So that was very important for me. That was giving me confidence and thinking, yeah, maybe this is where I fit in. But then after about 2 years, I decided to go back to New York, and then I became a solo performer, which was not in drag. I was just dressed kind of neutral pants and shirt, and played all these different characters without costumes. And I did that for about 6 years. Then ended up back in drag again when I started my theater company in New York City.
Mm. And that was...
So it's been kind of a strange route in and out of drag.
Yeah. You know? But you've been able to move in and out of drag, I guess, for the rest of your career, and in and out of wearing many different hats and wigs, we could say, professionally. You're anything nimble is one of the words I would say, versatile and nimble.
I get lots of ideas, and it's been kind of odd, I'm sort of the idea man, I seem to have been very fortunate that I kind of inspire other people to hook on, and they then help me make my ideas a reality.
Right.
So I've been very lucky that way. I guess I'm kind of Peter Pan and get everybody all worked up, and then we do them. So I've been extremely fortunate that almost really in the past couple decades, almost every notion I've had has come to fruition.
Well, and you can't sell yourself short on how much hard work that actually takes, and determination, and going from just managing like one's self in a solo piece to writing plays, which you've written a lot of them. And obviously the one that we mentioned in my introduction, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, really, put your flag on the moon, so to speak.
That was a big break. Yeah.
And what was the inspiration for Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, and how did you think you were going to go about tackling writing a play?
Well, I've been a solo performer, and I was very driven. This is in my early to, well, really through my 20s, and I was very determined, and I would, book myself around the country because I couldn't get any kind of management, and I actually then came back to Chicago, and I booked myself into Victory Gardens Theater. And it's ironic that all these years later, I'm back at Victory Gardens Theater doing this show on December 7th. It's only taken me about 29 years to get back. No, it's more than that. It's like 31. Oh, God. So, Dennis Zajac really kind of took a chance on me in 1978. To do the solo piece at Victory Gardens, and it was a huge disaster. I mean, it was a very small disaster as far as, it was in a little theater, but critics just hated it. It was pretty devastating. But, you know,
well, you've all come a long way. Them to Tony Awards and you to Tony nominations, and you both come a long way.
Thank you. But anyway, yes, a vampire lesbian, just to answer your question, you know, I'd been a solo performer and just really wasn't getting anywhere, and I was very discouraged. And then just when I was at my lowest ebb, I went to see a friend of mine perform, and it's very strange, rather frightening, after-hours bar, art gallery, performance space in a kind of what was then a very creepy abandoned neighborhood, you know, way on the far east side of Greenwich Village. And but I was so inspired. It seemed like it was like Berlin in the 20s. It was just decadent and marvelous. So I wanted to perform there, but I knew that I didn't want to just do my regular other minimalist you know, solo work. So I was working, I was also you know, always had to have a day job back then, and so I think I was working as an office temp. And just while I was, you know, sitting at the receptionist desk, I quickly, you know, wrote this little kind of 40-minute skit. And I think I'd read Interview with the Vampire, so, you know, that, you know, vampires always keep coming back, you know. And,
right.
You know, we're vampire crazy now, aren't we?
You can't kill them, can you?
Yeah, so that was in that spate of vampire lore. And so, yeah, so I just kind of wrote this silly kind of skit just to do in this club for a weekend and got my friends involved, and we did it. And I really didn't think I was going to be in drag. I did drag that weekend. I thought that would be it. Didn't realize that it would be my career. So, yeah, that just kind of started it, and I was in the right place at the right time, the East Village. Was being kind of gentrified and rediscovered, and this kind of wild performance art scene that was going on, and Madonna had kind of just come out of that milieu, and the artist Keith Haring, and suddenly it was a very exciting kind of climate. And you know, I was doing these plays with my little theater troupe with crazy titles like Vampire Lesbians of Sodom and Theodore, She Bitch of Byzantium, right. Pardon My Inquisition, or Kiss the Blood of My Castanets. And so we were getting lots of publicity, and we just kind of generated a big following very remarkably quickly. So, in a crazy way, it was the beginning of, during the beginning of the AIDS crisis, and there was such, there was this terrible fear in the air, and I think a lot of gay people started coming to see our performances. It was something to be to laugh and, and to be together and you know, laugh and be silly and in a very grim period.
How did you meet Julie Halston?
Well, I met her in San Francisco. We had a mutual friend who I went to summer camp with and she went to college with, and he kept telling each of us, oh, you got to meet, you know, he would say to me, you have to meet my friend Julie Halston. She's the funniest girl in the world. And that sounds really obnoxious. I thought, yeah, sure. And then we ended up meeting while I was performing in San Francisco, and she was visiting. And we you know, I liked her well enough. But then I would invite her to come see me perform in New York, because she was working on Wall Street, and she had a lot of friends. And when I would be desperate for an audience, you know, because I had a critic coming or something, I would just call everybody I knew, and you know, I had her name in my address book, and she would bring 10 people at a time. And I thought, wow, that's nice to know. And well, then when I first started performing in the East Village, I did two performances of Vampire Lesbians. And then I wanted to do a second weekend, and the actress playing the succubus opposite me didn't want to get, she'd had enough, you know, and she actually wanted to perform in places that actually had a bathroom backstage. So I was desperate, and after every flamboyant woman I knew, and they all turned me down, and my own sister turned me down, and the last person on my list was that girl, Julie Halston. I guess it doesn't matter, really. And so I called her up, and then suddenly we really bonded, and we We just became, you know, like brother and sister.
Yeah, it's
for,
been
for all these years. I've written, I think I've written maybe 12 roles for her over the years in movies and plays.
Isn't that crazy? A lifelong relationship born out of being the last on the list. But somebody knew it. Your friend, your mutual friend, obviously could see your see the connection.
Yeah, you know, we sit together.
You have had so much of your work has been nominated and won awards over the years. But I know for any theatrical artist, you know, there would be nothing like hearing your name announced on Tony Night. And The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, of course, made its way through the boards to Broadway.
It didn't win, though.
It didn't win, but still, I would think...
You get the wrong impression to, you know, that I won. I was nominated for Best Play, and I have to say, I was really lucky that the year that I was nominated, they actually showed on TV scenes from the nominated plays, and which they really almost never do anymore.
Right.
And they even had each playwright introduce their little scene, and so I actually got to be on stage at Radio City and introduce my, you know, scene, and you know, thrilling.
Yeah,
but I
would
knew
just
I wouldn't win. I knew I wasn't going to win, but it was awfully exciting.
Well, I just think it would be so validating as we started this conversation of, you know, I went to Northwestern because I thought I was going to be this contender, and how many theater artists have a lifetime perhaps having a career in the theater and never have that moment, even as a nominated artist. And to really see that, you know, that niche be carved. Did that change a trajectory for your career? Because I know since then you've gotten involved even more. Well, before then and after then, but you've expanded to working in film and directing more now as opposed to just writing. After you get the Tony nod, even has that kind of been a mountain that you've climbed, and now there are other media to explore?
Well, I guess it gave me, in the New York theater community, gave me a little more sort of commercial cred, but I don't think it really changed that much. You know, I've so enjoyed my career and my life just kind of as a sort of avant-garde, that word doesn't even fit me either, really. The career I've had off Broadway and doing all these plays, and it's been kind of fantastic. You know, I've just been this rare place that whatever fantasy I've had, I've been able to actually do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been sometimes on a smaller scale, you know, but I never really had the big ambition to, like, you know, like my big dream wasn't, oh, I'm going to win the Oscar. Someday I'm going to win an Oscar. I think, you know, maybe I'd be more successful if I thought in those broad strokes. My ambitions were always somewhat attainable, but they were difficult for me. But, you know, like my dream would be, oh, you know, when I was young, like, I've got to do my act in San Francisco. Somehow I've got to, you know, and I worked so hard, and then I achieved it. Then my dream is to somehow do my play off Broadway, and that was hard, you know. Mm-hmm. And really, my biggest dream, the big goal, was my goal is to earn my living in show business, to earn my living and not have to do, you know, any kind of day job or anything. And that's the hardest thing, is to earn your living doing what you love.
Right.
And that I've achieved, and I'm very, very proud of.
Yeah.
But it's funny, I never really thought that, like, oh, I've got to have a play on Broadway. But then circumstances happened that, you know, we did The Tale of the Allergist's Wife at a nonprofit theater, and then it transferred to Broadway, And I have to say, it was just the most thrilling thing. I mean, the day that the marquee went up at the Barrymore Theater, you know, I was there, and you know, it was pouring rain, torrential rain, and I just was soaked. And I was on the right side of the street looking at it. I went to the left side of the street looking at it. I went in front of it. You know, and everybody in the world should have a hit Broadway show. It's just, it was so thrilling. Everything about it, you know, I did not take it lightly. I was just thrilled, and but since then I've only really had one other Broadway show. I wrote the book to a rather notorious flop musical called Taboo.
Yes, the Rosie O'Donnell produced show. Yeah,
and that was kind of horrifying, but yeah, that's been my last Broadway gig, but hopefully it won't be the last.
So do you need to keep like the actor hat, the writer hat, the director hat? Do they all kind of, you know, need to be in the air that you could grab one at any time? Is that the most satisfying to you, to be that versatile? Or are you finding like directing is the most satisfying, or acting is still the most satisfying?
Well, I've done very little directing. I've really only directed one feature film, which went straight to video. But so I'm not that much of a director. But I think what I do best, I like when I write and act in it at the same time.
Mm.
But you know, I'm set certain limitations as an actor, and so for me to have a really full writing career, you know, I write plays that I'm not in, you know, because, you know, as a sort of drag diva, it's sort of, there's a certain kind of play that suits me.
Well, you know, but
I get lots of other ideas, so sometimes I'm not in it, sometimes I'm in it.
Well, but definitely, you know, you say you write it so you're in it, but I mean, I think it's very fascinating, and I have not seen this, and I want to get my hands on it. The documentary, The Lady in Question is Charles Bush, which is a documentary about you. How did that come about?
That was really cool, I have to say. There are these two guys I know, Charles Ignacio and John Catania, who had for years been producers of In the Life, you know, the PBS series. And I had done a number of segments and hosted some episodes of In the Life. So we knew each other. And they wanted to work on a theatrical feature-length documentary. So they came to me and said, would I be interested? And, well, you know, it was a narcissist dream, really.
Right.
A documentary about you. You know, sure, you know. And then they, you know, asked rather sheepishly if I had any archival footage of my performances. Because most theater people have no film on them. So, you know, they just had, when you see documentaries about theater people, usually it's just still photos. But, you know, a big part of my career was when I had my own theater company, and we were all best friends. So we used to just video ourselves all the time. We videoed ourselves watching the video.
Right.
So, you know, and so they said, well, do you have anything? I said, do I ever? I've got 77 tapes.
Wow.
So it became, you know, it really was great in this documentary that while all of us would talk about an incident, you know, on stage, you could actually see it, you know, see it.
Yeah.
So it was great. So, yeah, I mean, it went on for a long time. I mean, they were following me around for about 3 years, and at a certain point, it was kind of like being on the longest reality show in existence. And got a little, you know, a little tiresome sometimes, like, you know, now what? But when it was done, you know, they did such a great job, and it was extremely moving for all of us, the people in my world, you know, my family and my friends and colleagues, for us to sit back and see our lives in front of us. I mean, it was, you know, it was very, very emotional.
Yeah. I have to get a copy
good.
Of it.
It's
so
really
I can
good,
see it.
Yeah. And then, you know, it was also kind of sweet. You know, my theater company, you know, we had been all such so tight and so close, and then, you know, life just kind of cast you in different directions, and we kind of, you know, in some cases weren't speaking, and in other cases just, you know, went off in, you know, different directions. But then when it was time to publicize the documentary, you know, we all were sort of brought together again and kind of rediscovered each other. It was very lovely.
Well, it's going to be a bit of a rediscovery on December 7th when you and Julie are on stage for this evening with the two of you. What can we expect? What is the evening going to constitute?
I don't, you know, I get worried when sometimes we send out pictures and of me in drag, you know, and I don't want people to think that we're doing Vampire Lesbians of Sodom or something.
Right.
This is kind of a show that Julie and I gradually have been developing in different formats over the last couple of years, and it's basically Julie and I as ourselves telling our story and anecdote of our friendship. And the work we've done together, and then along the way we'll show some film clips. We'll also do some scenes from different plays that I've written, and it's, you know, it's I think it's a funny evening, and also we go to a real place, you know, and we talk about the different, you know, even the periods in our lives where we we had a kind of a big feud. We lost about five years foolishly of our friendship, just silliness, and then we were smart enough to get back together again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about all this, and it's a very full evening.
So it's really just the story of your lives, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like a bit of a presentation of the story of your lives together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, and how we've kind of inspired each other. I kind of helped her find herself as a comedian, and mm-hmm. then she inspired me as a writer.
I remember seeing her in a one-woman show. I guess it was in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the show that I saw. It was called Julie Halston's Lifetime of Comedy. And
yeah.
We'd been working so closely for years together, and she kept her wistfully saying that she liked to do a comedy act,
mm-hmm.
and I just knew that she just wasn't going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a bunch of cabaret owners, because I used to perform in cabarets in New York, early on. So I went to see this friend of mine who had a very nice club, and I said, you know, Julia Halston is my sidekick on stage. You know, it's so funny, and would you just book her? You know, she doesn't have an act right now, but I guarantee you she will.
Yeah.
If you just, you know, so I got to the theater that night. We were doing a play together, and I went into Julie's dressing room, and I said, well, honey, you know, I hope you're free on November 1st, because you're booked to do an act at 88th Cabaret.
Wow.
She said, oh, my God, you know, I gave her shit about not too long, maybe 2 months to get her act together, literally.
Yeah.
And she was terrified, but she did it, and she did it great, and it began a whole new career for her.
Yeah, I remember seeing her. I had just come out, and I was in New York with my first girlfriend, and we went to go see her. And I remember that very distinctly.
She's a great gal. You know, I just love her so much, and she's outrageous and very smart, and is such an important part of my life. And I think it's an interesting story. I think that, you know, we all have these kind of friendships,
mm-hmm.
and we try to tell it in a way that has a, you know, kind of a universal appeal that people can identify with, as opposed to just, you know, and then I wrote.
Or, right.
You know, yeah.
You are a dreamer, so I want to know, because you've just said, you know, I have these dreams, and somehow they manifest through wonderful people I know who bring along with me to dream the dream with me. What is the next dream for Charles?
Well, Julie and I are going to do a new play of mine in February here in New York, and we're sort of trying something out. Like all sorts of things happening. You know, I've been doing, I got kind of a big TV thing, starting to work on, but you know, they can kill it at any step of the way. So you kind of don't want to talk about it because it most likely won't happen. But it'd
well,
be
promise
exciting.
You'll come back if it does happen, and you can tell me that, Drew.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But the one with Julie in February is happening.
Yes. Well, the thing is, you know, every once in a while, I find that I have to do something really just to kind of reclaim the just the pure joy of performing. And you know, how to explain this? Just, you know, you can get kind of wrapped up in just sort of, you know, working on things. Just, what is this going to get me in my career? And what is, you know, and will the critics like this? And will it be successful? And you lose the ultimate, you know, core of it, which is to entertain and to, you know, and it has to be kind of fun. And sometimes I do lose that, and so I have to kind of replenish that the well. So every couple of years, you know, I do something where we don't invite any critics, and we do it in a kind of a funky sort of downtown space. And so so I have this new play called The Divine Sister, and it's kind of a, I guess you'd say it's an homage to every movie that Hollywood made about religion. And so I play a very lovely and embattled Mother Superior of the convent, and Julie's my wisecracking nun sidekick. And oh, just everything happens. It's part Agnes of God, part Song of Bernadette, Trouble of Angels, and the Da Vinci Code all wrapped into one.
Oh, I love it.
So we're gonna do it, but I hope we find an audience, because we won't be inviting any critics, which is, you know, reviews is how you usually get a audience.
Oh, you got Twitter and Facebook and podcasts and the World Wide Web.
And YouTubing and Twittering.
Exactly.
And Facebooking, and that's how we'll find out. And we're only doing it for 4 weeks, so, you know, so hopefully we'll, you know, because it's sort of like an I Love Lucy episode. I feel like I'm paying for the whole thing on a post-dated check.
Well, we will look for that in the new year and look to tap into some end-of-year fun with you all, as this is really an exciting series that Victory Garden's been doing, the Fresh Squeeze series of queer artists coming in town for one night only. So this is a one-night-only event. This coming Monday, December 7th, 2009. Show's at 7:30. Tickets are $30 in advance or $35 the day of the show. If you'd like tickets, we'll have this on our show notes, but you can visit victorygardens.org and go check out An Evening with Charles Bush and Julie Halston, all happening at the Victory Gardens Biograph Theater. Charles, thank you so much, and we'll see you on the 7th.
Yeah, thank you.
Got something to say? Today, 312-21-BE-GAY.
So, Kelly.
Yes?
Have you made your Christmas list yet?
What I want or what I'm gonna... I haven't. I'm having a lot of weird feelings about Christmas this year.
Uh-oh. What does that mean?
Not weird feelings, but feelings of... I get very panic-stricken around the holidays. I'm sure, you know, take a number and get in that long line. There's a lot, and it's probably a lot of it is self-imposed, a lot of pressure to buy people things, to buy the right things, to buy exciting things that people are going to love, to do something interesting and unique.
You know, most people just go and get the gift cards.
It's true, and that would probably be an easy Christmas to buy everybody a gift card.
Get everybody a gift card, then they can buy exactly what they want. It can be a surprise.
True. I would love to get gift cards.
How
from
simple
people.
For you. And then you can just show up and be, you know, emotionally present with people as opposed to wrapped up in knots. You can give me a gift card.
I'm not wrapped up in knots. It feels like a lot for a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yep.
The shopping, the wrapping, the trying to, you know, do something different and unique and very special to the person to whom you're giving it. And, you know, I don't know.
Shouldn't we just be special to the person 52 weeks out of the year and not worry about that one day?
Yeah, I think that's the goal, but I think a lot of people try to make up for it with the gift giving.
Well,
I couldn't show up for you on a daily basis, but here's a brand new car.
But if you live well and you show up to people well, then you don't have to make up for anything at the end
that's
of the year.
That's true.
And I don't think that you're, you know, you're not a shitty friend or family member, so you're probably okay.
For the most part, I don't think I'm a shitty friend or a family member. I'm getting a lot better. I just wish, for me, I wish the holidays, and this is something that you create, one creates for mm-hmm. themselves, I think, this kind of, you know, barometer for how their holidays are going to go. So it's kind of up to me
yeah.
where that goes. But I think more and more the older that I get, it becomes more about just being present with people.
Yep.
And really kind of fulfilling this quality of the holiday, which to me is just being around people that you love and being present with them and honoring, you know, a spirited clause of kindness yep. and goodwill and service and all those things. That sounds very, very hokey, but...
No, I mean, I love the holiday season and in many ways.
A little nog, a little cider with a stick of cinnamon.
Little cider with a stick. You know, we put our tree up and it makes me happy. It's a fake tree. We have a candle that smells like tree, so it seems like a real tree. People come up and sniff our tree. But I just love having the tree up. You know, for me, that's enough.
It's a glorious tree.
And I love to do little things that feel like the holiday season, the least of which is shopping.
What are the little things that you love to do?
I love to go to people's holiday parties. We normally host something throughout the holiday season, sometime between Thanksgiving and New Year's, which is a way, I think, to open up your home and have people over for that. I do send Christmas cards. I think it's just a nice way to say to somebody, I'm thinking of you and your family. You know, I mean, I don't mind walking around little neighborhoods while people are shopping. I just don't truly enjoy shopping. I don't enjoy that part of it. Though, if somebody else would shop for me, I love wrapping gifts. Like, I like wrapping the gifts. I just don't love shopping. And, you know, we go to a party every year, which I think is so fantastic. A couple of women that we know every year have a party where the point of the party is, of course, they have, you know, food and beverages, but and people visit, but everybody, they adopt a family or two, and we bring gifts for that family, and then they deliver those gifts. And I think that's one of the most extraordinary things I get to do every year. I really look forward to their party because it's fun to just either pick a child or the parent that you're going to buy a gift for and take that. And
We're buying sheets.
Don't tell her. I don't even know her name, but we're buying some purple sheets.
If you're listening, lady.
But I think that, you know, those kind of things I really enjoy. And I enjoy being with my family, you know, and whether it's just people being off work and spending some time together. Watch, you and I even have started the season off by watching some old black and white movies on the classic Turner Classic Movie channel. You know, we watch Singing in the Rain on Thanksgiving night, and Some Like It Hot. And I just think doing those kind
some
of
do.
Things. Some like it hot.
I think Adam Lambert does.
I think he likes it hot.
Mr. Bush probably likes it hot as well.
Who?
Mr. Bush.
Oh,
Charles
no.
Bush.
Yes, Charles Bush. It's true. He does like it hot. And spicy.
Who?
And a cinnamon with a cinnamon stick.
A cinnamon stick.
A cinnamon stick. But, you know, so I guess what we're saying is the holiday season is upon us, and we all get to choose how we manifest the holidays, whether we're celebrating right. Hanukkah or solstice or Kwanzaa. We always get invited to a solstice party every year, so we know.
Do we?
Yes, we do. Don, Sam, and Kiers.
Oh, right. Solstice party.
So, you know, there's different ways to celebrate, but it's truly a time, I think, of just gratitude and being with people that we care about and giving to others. And that doesn't have to be about a massive shopping spree.
It's true.
I hope. Though I would like all of my Windy City QueerCast family to know you're all getting very expensive gifts this year. Kelly, thanks for being on the show.
Great to be here.
And I'm sure we'll talk to you again, if not...
I'm sure I'll talk to you right after you switch this off. I'm sure we'll have a few words.
But the podcast people will get to hear you again, maybe before the new year.
I hope so.
And if not, in the new year.
Great.
Thanks for listening to another Windy City QueerCast. This program is brought to you in part by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow. Special thanks to our QueerCast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueerCast.com and iTunes. The next QueerCast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now.
Roma, Roma, Gaga, ooh la la, what's your bad romance?